So, I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning to practice Zen. And everybody who has been sitting today has been making a wonderful effort. A number of people got here at 7 and have been sitting all through the morning. And if you weren't able to do that, but you're here now, I'm very happy to see you. And if you were able to come at 9:30, that's wonderful. So thank you very much for coming and practicing. The Saturday sits are a wonderful opportunity to really deepen your practice. You know, when you hopefully, I hope you have the chance to sit regularly at your home. You know, this is in some ways a terrible situation. We're trapped. We can't go to the beach. We can't go out to dinner at our favorite restaurant. Many of us have been working at home for months and months. And I don't know about you, but it's definitely the case that I find it difficult sometimes to just get up and go back into my room and face my computer and spend the day in front of my computer and where I do my work. And I go for walks or I go for jogs, but there's something about this confinement that's getting a little old. But in another way, you know, this is sort of perfect. This is sort of perfect. Because let's face it, you know, the modern world is based on distractions. I mean, we in the modern world have found a way of commodifying pleasure, commodifying information, commodifying interest, and commodifying things like beauty, natural beauty, and so on. So, the more people consume of all these things, the better. And so the society is really constructed to stimulate people, to invite to stimulate what Buddhism calls their craving, and to invite them to seek out new forms of experience, which has a good side. But it's definitely the case that we're distracted a lot of the time, and there's so many distractions, and they're so tempting. So, you know, in a certain way, this calamity, and it's a calamity. Lots of people have lost their jobs and may not get them back for years and years. People have died. More than 130,000 Americans have died. So in all of these ways, it's a calamity. But in another way, you know, there's something really eye-opening about realizing, you know, that basically, when they take your distractions away, when they take your entertainments away, and so on, you know, life has this kind of simplicity that people don't know what to do with, you know. And some people can experience it as boring, some people can experience it as depressing, because when you take away all the novelty, you know, every day is pretty much like Groundhog Day, if you've seen the movie Groundhog Day, right? You get up, you go downstairs, you know, I get up and do zazen, then I maybe go for a jog, then I come home and I have breakfast and I have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, then I work. Now we have meditation 3 times in the evening, so that fills 3 of my evenings and every other Saturday. But you know, basically the next day I go to sleep and I get up and it's exactly the same. And I'm sure that's pretty much the same for you right now. Hopefully you have projects you're engaged in, but you know, we all have socially induced craving. You know, we all crave novelty because our culture has addicted us to novelty, just all kinds of stimulation. And it's still the case that you can get on the internet and spend the whole day surfing the web and pulling in information, and that is interesting. But all the same, you know, people are in a very positive situation, even though they're going through withdrawal right now. Because, you know, when you simplify your life like that, I think it gives you the chance to decide maybe that you have been distracted, and pursuing things that weren't important. And then suddenly you realize, you know, life is really going to be many days just like this, and then it's going to be over. I was reading, I'm a subscriber to Rolling Stone magazine, and there was an interview with Bruce Springsteen, the great Bruce Springsteen, and he said, you know, I'm 70 years old, and he said, I'm sitting here at home, and I feel like the sand is running through the hourglass, and this is the time when I should be using the precious energy I still have left out on the road, you know, performing my music, and instead I'm stuck at home. And I thought that was so moving, right? Because I think we're all sort of in that situation. It's like we've been shipwrecked, you know, and we're trapped on this island. And every day the island has the internet, we have coffee or tea, you know, hopefully nobody's going hungry. But there's a kind of like the sun comes up and the sun goes down, and the sun comes up and the sun goes down. And, you know, actually, that's very, you know, that's very close to the way people like Zen Buddhist monks and nuns live, right? Very similar. You know, basically, you know, we have, if you read books on Zen, it seems like every day at the monastery is this wonderful adventure. If you read koans and so on, people put their shoes on their head, or they slap each other's faces, or they push each other down. But actually, you know, in a monastery, people have to simplify their lives. It's right down. It's every day is going to be the same as every other day. It's like that. And for many people, that's like a death sentence. That sounds like a terrible thing. But actually, you know, it's true for all of us. Every day is really going to be just like every other day. And, you know, we're sort of confronting that. You know, the beauty of distractions is that it keeps us from noticing that, right? You know, when I was in college, I dated a woman who was, you know, I thought she was fascinating, and until I couldn't stand it anymore. And, you know, she was, I would hang out with her, and she would spend her whole day visiting people and doing errands. So it would be like Monday, she'd get up and she'd have a big list of people to visit and talk to, and I'd ride around with her, and we'd go and visit people and talk, and then we'd buy things at the store, and then we'd go home, and every day was like that. And after a while, I felt like we're not doing anything. You know, I just want to sit down and read a book. And this woman was a lovely person, and I'm sure she's had a wonderful life, but I felt that she was just filling up every minute of her day with some distraction. And I think in that way, she's like all of us to some degree. So it's really interesting, and in a way, it's a great gift that we're sort of shipwrecked, and we're on this island, and we can see every day is going to be like every other day. Right? It's just every day is going to be like every other day. And a lot of our distractions have been taken away. And that makes it possible, I think, you know, to ask some really important questions. You know, who are we? Where do we come from? And where are we going? And I think those are questions really wonderfully worth asking. You know, who are we? Where do we come from? And where are we going? You know, when you begin to ask those questions, you know, I think something like Zen makes a lot more sense. You know, in the United States today, I would say, unfortunately, the form of Buddhism that has become popular is mindfulness meditation, which is a very stripped down practice of concentrating the mind in order to get a certain degree of mental focus. And people actually practice. I'm always amazed at how people write me emails and say, I haven't done Zen, but I've done mindfulness meditation. I'd like to learn Zen. But the thing that my objection to mindfulness meditation is that it doesn't really ask these questions, right? It basically says, here's a set of tools for you to use in your life, and you can use them to any purpose that you want. You know, you can if you're working 24 hours a day, you can use mindfulness to focus your mind when you're exhausted, or to refresh yourself when you're feeling burned out, and go for it. And I feel that something really important is lost. You know, when we sit down on the cushion and we begin to practice meditation, you know, we have the chance to really change our lives, to really come to terms with what's important. You know, there's a koan that says, when you die, what will happen to you? There's actually a koan like that. And in order to answer it, you really have to know, believe it or not. You don't have to die, but you have to be able to answer that question. When you die, what will happen to you? Or where will you go, is the koan. And I think that's a wonderful question. You know, every day is going to pretty much be like every other day. And, you know, tomorrow the sun may shine, and tomorrow it may rain, and tomorrow I may get a raise, and I may not get a raise, and, this might happen, and this might, but every day is going to be the same. So who are we? Where do we come from? And where are we going? Where are we going? And, you know, one way to address that question is to read a lot of books, and please do that. You know, read widely, read philosophy, please read the sutras. You know, we have a sutra study group every other Sunday, and I hope you think about joining it. We're just about to finish the Diamond Sutra, and we're moving into a new sutra, and following Sunday we'll finish the Diamond Sutra, and then we'll be going into the Lankavatara Sutra, another sutra. So you're warmly invited to attend. And you can read Nietzsche, and you can read Schopenhauer, and you know, feel free to do that. But you know, what we do in Zen is to focus on the mind, right? Or the body mind consciousness. And when we sit down on the cushion and we stabilize our minds, we go through it's like pulling back a curtain, and then pulling back another curtain, and pulling back another curtain, right? At every stage, there's a kind of transformation of your consciousness, or a kind of liberation. So, you know, when people begin to do meditation for the first time, you know, they come to the Zendo, or they join online, and, you know, the teacher usually teaches them how to sit with your back straight up on the mat, breathing from the hara, from the dantian, and you squeeze the breath out until it's gone, and you squeeze the breath out, and you know, for a long time, for like 3 weeks or 4 weeks, it's a big struggle not to think, because all day long, you know, basically we're in the mode of thinking. You know, we are using language to describe our experiences to ourselves. And most people rarely had any other kind of experience. You know, but when people begin to sit down on the cushion and they begin to watch the breath, sooner or later they begin to have experiences that aren't mediated by language. And often that's a really powerful experience, you know. When you sit down on the cushion, it takes about 3 weeks, but you begin to have this, you begin to enter a state of consciousness where you're simply present in a nonverbal way with what's happening from moment to moment. And usually when people experience that, it feels great. It's called, in Zen, we call that samadhi. Samadhi. So you sit down on the cushion, you enter samadhi, and you begin to have this experience of nonverbal awareness. And in nonverbal awareness, you feel very connected to the things around you. You feel very, it's almost like a release and a connection. A few years ago, there was a woman who was a neuroscientist. I don't know if you heard about this book, but it was called Stroke of Insight. And she was a neuroscientist, and she actually had a serious stroke. And when the stroke happened, she lost her language faculty. And they, rushed her to the hospital, and she had, reparative treatment. But for a long time, she didn't have language. So she was sort of in this state people can enter after a month or two of doing zazen. She said later she recovered her language faculty, right? She went through, took her several years of therapy, and she began to remember language and to use language. And she wrote this whole book, and it's a wonderful book. She's a very good writer. But she said, during that period when she didn't have language, it was like heaven. She said, everything was so alive. Everything was magical, right? And she said recovering language, of course, brought her back into the world of human beings, right? The language is the world as humans, the abstract world as humans that we share. And she could re-enter the world of human beings through language. But she said that period where she had no words, everything comes alive. And if you've been doing zazen for just a little while, you probably haven't had that experience yet. But if you have been doing zazen for, a year or two, I'm sure you've had those experiences where, you sit down on the cushion, you're very stressed, and you begin to decompress, and the thoughts are flowing thickly across your field of attention for a while, and then they thin out, and then they begin to go away, and there's these empty spaces. And we zazen, we Zen people spend a lot of time in those empty spaces. And when we do, we begin to experience things differently. So today, when you leave here, if you've been sitting all morning, or when you leave your home, your living room, or wherever you're practicing right now, you go outside, everything may seem so rich and wonderful. That experience of going through samadhi, entering a wordless state of samadhi, and then going back into the world of form is magical. It's really wonderful. But that's not what Zen people or what Buddhist people think of as enlightenment, but it is a kind of liberation. It's a wonderful experience. When you've gone into deep samadhi, you enter this thoughtless state and you begin to experience things around you as yourself. We've been meditating for, by the end of the day, we have meditated for 5 hours. You go outside and you hear a bird, and because there's not this screen of anxiety, powerful emotional turbulence, and there's not this screen of thinking, the sound of the bird is so present that you merge with the sound of the bird. And some of you have been to our retreats, our sesshin, and you've had that experience probably on day three of sesshin, where you're sitting in the zendo, and all of a sudden you start hearing the birds, and it's like you become one with the birds around you. Or at lunchtime, we're served, we have our three bowls, and one, the big bowl is full of rice. And you look down at the rice and you become the rice. I've mentioned before that there was a very famous Zen master Soen Nakamura was his name, Soen Roshi. And he was the Dharma brother of my first teacher, Genki Roshi. And Genki Roshi said that when he went to a sesshin where Soen Roshi was in attendance, and they served the rice, and they were reciting the meal sutras, right? And he looked over, and the tears were just running down Soen Roshi's face. And, you know, I'm confident that he was in deep samadhi and was one with the rice, right? Becoming one with the rice. You know, we feel so separate because of all of our distractions. You know, the distractions actually have the effect of making us feel separate all the time. That, you know, it doesn't take very much zazen to get past that experience of separateness and begin to have this feeling like you're merging, or you're connected to, or part of, or one with the world around you. And that's a really major breakthrough. You know, so the first stage of Zen practice is just learning that you have a consciousness that doesn't think in words. You know, and that then the next stage in Zen practice is, if you stay in that place long enough, you begin to experience like merger with the objects around you. You begin to experience like your connectedness with things. And it's really a blissful, beautiful state. Anybody who's been to sesshin, at the end of sesshin, it's like every blade of grass is alive. But, you know, even that is not actually enlightenment, according to Buddhist teaching. You know, so it's definitely the case that we can enter a thoughtless state. It's definitely the case that we can feel deeply connected to the world around us. And that sense of deep connection is really wonderful and really reassuring. But, you know, even though this is true, even though you can have these experiences, they're not what we in Zen would call enlightenment. Because, you know, if you continue to practice, you know, you begin to notice that, you begin to notice other things about your awareness, right? So, you know, if you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath and you enter a thoughtless state, and you hear the sounds around you and you begin to merge with the sounds around you, you know, you'll notice something kind of interesting, right? That you're having experiences, but you're not choosing those experiences. They're happening without your volition, without your choice. Or so when you're sitting on the cushion, you suddenly notice the pain in your leg, let's say. Then you hear somebody sitting next to you breathing, and maybe a little too hard. Then you hear a bird outside. Then you think of your brother. Then you think about lunch. Then you feel the pain in your leg. Then you look down and you see sunlight on the floor. Then you hear wind blowing through the trees. Now, you know, if you're just observing all of these things, you can become one with them. But the interesting thing is that you're not choosing these things. You're aware of, you're not consciously choosing to have these experiences. You're just having them. And you aren't deciding at this moment, I'm going to hear the wind instead of paying attention to what's happening on the floor. You know, there was just to clarify what I'm saying, if you do enough sitting, you realize that your mind is doing a lot of work that you're not in charge of. So for example, there was a study that some scientists did that really astonished the world of neuroscience. they put electrodes on a person's head, and they were basically trying to measure a person's arm. When does a person, what happens when you choose to move your arm? What happens when you choose to move your arm? What happens neurologically when you choose to move your arm? So, they wired this guy's head up and they said, now move your arm. And they wanted to see how long it took his brain to send the command to the arm and for the arm to actually move. I hope this is making some sense. But what they wanted to see was, when I say to my fingers, move, how long does it take my fingers to actually move? See, now, is this, I hope this is clear. And what they discovered was, though, this, that actually I start moving my fingers before I give the command to move my fingers. Does that make it? So your fingers are already moving when you think move. See, I hope this is making some sense. In other words, before you even choose to move, you're already moving. See, that's interesting, right? And I think it's really important. And the thing is, what you could conclude from that was that there is a deeper part of our mind which is actually in charge of our awareness and even our actions. And the conscious part of our mind is like the topmost part of the mind. And the conscious part of the mind thinks it's making the choice to move my hand or salivate or think about lunch, but it's not. It's actually the conscious part of the mind is along for the ride and it's pretending that it's in charge, if this makes any sense. So there are other, I'm not a not brain scientist, but there are other things in the world of brain science which is very similar to this, where people will do things and then they will make up reasons for doing them after they've done them. But the reasons are just excuses because they weren't really in charge, right? This is a well-known issue in psychotherapy, right? So the thing is, there's a part of your mind which is doing a lot of work, and the conscious part of your mind isn't that part. The conscious mind isn't putting your world together for you. It isn't telling you, get up and look at the trees. You're getting up and looking at the trees, and you say, oh, I just decided to get up and look at the trees. Now, if you do enough meditation, you begin to notice this all the time. That the conscious part of your mind is not really making any of this happen. It's just along for the ride. See? And there's a deeper part of the mind which is like orchestrating all of this. See, orchestrating all this. In Zen practice, we discover this by doing what we call koan practice, okay, in Zen. So the teacher will give the student a koan just like this one. So you have been meditating all morning, and let's say we're at a sesshin and you come in to see me and I give you this koan and I say that the main part of the koan is a monk asked Uman, what is Dharmakaya? Uman said, beyond the six. So you can go back to your cushion and you can sit there and think, what is the six? What could he mean by the six? See, what could the six be? I have six senses. I have five senses. I have five senses, so it can't be six senses. What could it be beyond the six? So, you sit there for a while and you try to figure out the koan, and then you decide, okay, I can't figure it out. And I'm going to do what the teacher says. I'm just going to sit there and go into a blank mind, a thoughtless state, and wait for the answer to come up. Wait for the answer. And if you don't know that there's a deeper mind that is orchestrating all of this, that there's a mind that makes the hand move before you know you're going to move your hand, this wouldn't make any sense. But actually, you know, Buddhists have known about this deeper mind for a very long time. Like that, you know, like almost 2,000 years, long before like Freud and people like that. So what we learn in Zen is that, you know, the little mind is the mind that says, I just chose to get off the cushion and look at the tree, but I was already getting up before I made that choice. That little mind's just along for the ride. It doesn't know much. It thinks it knows everything. It just makes it, but it doesn't. It doesn't know much. There's a deeper mind that actually is in charge, right? And when we practice koan practice, you know, we're beginning to activate that deeper mind, that deeper mind. So you know, that experiment, when I read about the experiment with the hand and the electrodes and so on, it was very exciting to me, because actually in Zen we learn how to, we experience that. There are actually koans that let us experience that for ourselves. You know, we don't have electrodes in the Zendo, but we experience that for ourselves. You know, some of you have been practicing with me for a long time, and we do something called calding mu. So if you're working on the mu koan, you're sitting on the cushion, you're calling mu, and when you call mu, your mind goes blank. And at some point, your teacher says to you, I want you actually to call mu out loud. Come into the Zendo and call mu out loud. So you're actually supposed to come into the Zendo and go mu. And my teacher, Genki Roshi, used to say to me, I would go in to see Genki Roshi, and he would say, that's okay. I'd come in and go moo, and you go, that's okay. And I'd come in and go moo, and he said, that's okay. And then he said, look, Kurt, don't come in here and call moo unless you could at least knock me over with it. So it became this challenge to call mu, and I tried everything. I would come in and I would scream mu at the top of my lungs until I would actually get hoarse. And he would just keep saying, no, that's not it, that's not it. And then, you know, one day I had completely given up on ever answering the mu koan. And I came in and I sat down on the cushion and in the Dokusan. I had been meditating all day. I went in to see the Roshi, and I just had this attitude like, I'm never going to answer this koan. And I opened my mouth and I called mu, and it was like a force of nature was coming out of my body. You know, it was like this absolute, it was just like, where did that come from? You know, sometimes when people have emergencies, they discover this. So I remember reading years ago in the newspaper that there had been a car accident, and some kid was under a car that had crashed, and like his mother, who was a very small person, lifted the car, you know, up. So he, you know, where did that energy come from? Well, you know, in Zen we learn how to activate or make contact with the big mind, what we call the big mind. And when we begin to activate or make contact with the big mind, we start learning how this mind works. You know, so when you get up in the morning and you walk outside, you hear a bird. You didn't choose to hear a bird. That was chosen for you by the big mind. And then when you smell the flowers, that was chosen for you by the big mind. And advanced practitioners of meditation begin to realize or experience directly that the conscious mind that's making these decisions is really not the big mind. It's not the mind that's knitting together all of my experience of reality. And the more you practice Zen, the more you begin to understand this mind. You begin to understand this mind. So, when you begin to practice this way, you begin to realize that the mind is sort of like knitting together or putting together the world of our experience. It's like there's an intelligence putting together our world without really any understanding or effort on our part. And we in Zen call this the big mind. But also in Zen, also in Buddhist tradition, it's called, another word for it is Dharmakaya. Dharmakaya, which means literally body of the Buddha. You could say mind of the Buddha. Buddha mind. And a lot of Zen practice is learning how to trust that deeper intelligence. Learning how to trust that deeper intelligence. So the whole point of a koan is to like put you in a place where your small mind can't solve the question, can't resolve the koan. And you have to rely on the big mind. And this process goes on and on for many years. It's the reason why it's so important, I think, to, you know, if you've been doing this for a while, you know, and you've experienced deep samadhi or deep fusion with the world around you, not to stop there, because there's an even more enlightening experience waiting for you if you continue to go through this process of getting lost and then making connection with the big mind. And one way to think about it is that the more time you spend surrendering control to the big mind, the closer you get to enlightenment. You know, the enlightenment is really the moment when, right, let me put it this way, for a long time in your practice, you're curt, and at first you don't know you have a big mind, but after, say, a number of sessions, you begin to think, well, maybe there is a big mind after all. Maybe there is such a thing. Maybe it exists. And then you practice more. You know, you keep practicing and you have these experiences where somehow you answer your koan, or you somehow feel transformed and you don't know why, or you feel blocked, and then suddenly all of these things that have blocked you for years, all of these barriers disappear. You know, if you keep going through this process, there's eventually a moment where there's a shift. And you could say, instead of being curt, having an experience of your big mind having an experience of curt. And that is enlightenment. Right? That experience is what we Zen people call enlightenment. So, you know, for the first period of our lives in Zen, we're sort of going up the mountain, as they say. And, you know, it's hard to get to the cushion. It's hard to stop thinking. It's hard to get into samadhi. It's hard to have an empty mind. And then it's very hard to trust the big mind. And we go through all of these koans. But every time you surrender you surrender control to your big mind, and you let the big mind sort of take charge of your practice, you're getting closer and closer to that shift. And when it happens, it's really deeply transformative. You know, this is enlightenment. So this koan is really about that experience of surrendering to big mind, and allowing yourself to be, allowing your little mind to be lost and confused, and then allowing the big mind to come to your rescue. This is like the pattern of koan training. And every time the big mind comes to your rescue, it's nice to answer your koan, but it feels like a door opening in yourself. And each time you answer the koan, it's like the door opens and then it closes a little bit. And then, you know, you do another koan and the door opens and it closes a little bit. And, you know, it's like you have a little glimpse of big mind and then it closes up. And you have another glimpse of big mind and it closes up. But, you know, if you continue to practice, if you continue to go through this process, eventually, you know, it doesn't close. It's like you step through that door and you see yourself face to face, your true nature face to face. So, everybody I have trained with has had this experience. You know, my first teacher, Genki Roshi, had this experience when he was about 40 years old, something like that. And my second teacher, Kangan Webb, had gone to Japan and had trained for about 10 years and had come back to the United States and was actually leading a sesshin here in the United States outside of Seattle when he had this experience. And, people thought he was having a nervous breakdown, his good friend of his who was in charge of training at Eheiji, which is one of the major Zen temples in Japan, invited Webb to come there. And while Webb was there, his friend had his Daikensho. So, you know, I think that if we're practicing Zen, you know, we should definitely practice Zen for the benefits of Zen. You'll be calmer, you'll be happier, you'll be more efficient on your job, you'll be able to work extra hours if you need to work extra hours, and so on. But I think the most important thing is to realize who we really are. That I think Buddhist practice is really about coming face to face with who we really are. Buddha, we say Buddha mind, Dharmakaya. And I guess it's possible for people to lose sight of that. You know, Zen has many benefits, but, you know, what Buddhists call enlightenment is, I think, quite real. And if you are practicing Zen to deal with your stress, please do that. If you're practicing Zen to, get inspiration in your work, it definitely gives you that too. But please, somewhere in the back of your mind, please keep enlightenment as your goal. Life is, in the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha says life is over like that, right? It's like a blink. At the end of your life, you look back and you say, wow, that was fast. So, you know, everybody this morning got up and came here to practice Zen. And we all have different motivations, but please make one of your motivations waking up. You know, please make one of your motivations waking up. Please don't, you know, I would say, you can't make enlightenment happen by sitting many painful sits. So don't do that to yourself, right? You can't make enlightenment happen by fasting until to the point of death, right? Because the Buddha said, don't even try that. It's not work. It's not going to work. You know, the way you get closer to enlightenment is just to steadily practice day by day, week by week, going to sesshin. You know, that's how it's done. You can't make it happen. There isn't a timetable, and it's going to happen when it's going to happen. But please keep it at the forefront of your attention. Somewhere in your mind, you should say, oh, yes, I'm on the road to enlightenment. My goal is to wake up in this life. Don't lose that goal. Don't lose sight of that objective. You know, please don't stop halfway up the mountain. Please say to yourself, look, you know, I've been practicing for X number of years, you know. There's something about this I find liberating. I want to see my true nature face to face. And when people say that, you might think, oh my God, it's impossible. I'll never wake. Don't think that way. Just say, this is my goal. This is my goal. You know, I don't know how many lifetimes it's going to take, but I'm going to pursue it. You know, if I don't get it tomorrow, I'm not going to feel bummed out, right? I'm not going to feel disappointed, but it's there. It's my goal, right? It's my goal to meet the Dharmakaya face to face. That is what Buddhism is all about. Okay. Umans, beyond the six. Ango's introduction, heaven never speaks, yet the four seasons follow their courses. Earth does not talk, but all things prosper. Where the four seasons follow their courses, you can see the substance. Where all things prosper, you can find the use. Now tell me, where do you see the monk? Stop your speech, your actions, your daily routine, and closing your throat and lips, say it. Main subject, a monk asked Umon, what is the Dharmakaya? Umon said, beyond the six. So in a way, Umon is saying, look, don't stop until you have met the Dharmakaya face to face. Don't, you know, your practice should be, I love Zen. Every time I sit, I feel good about it. I don't always have a great sit, but I feel pretty good after I get up. You know, the way of Zen is basically happy if you practice regularly. So it's not about beating yourself up. But don't stop until you come face to face with the Dharmakaya. Please. That's what he's really saying. Okay. Beyond the six. Setro's verse. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Even the blue-eyed Indian monk, Bodhidharma, Dhammo, cannot count it. Rashly, they say, Shorin passed it on to Shinko. Or he, clad in the robe, journeyed back to India. In other words, rashly, they say, Bodhidharma passed it on to Shinko. Or that he went back to India. India is vast and far. He is not to be found. Lo, since last night, he has been here facing Nyoho. Okay. So we all read stories about people who have enlightenment experiences. Yes? And the koan is really saying, it's saying, don't think when you read those stories, those people are unlike you, right? They're just like you, if that makes any sense, you know. The Buddha had pain in his legs, the Buddha didn't want to get up early, etc., etc. He just kept going, and he had the goal of face-to-face encounter with the Dharmakaya. Please make that your goal. Okay, that's what the koan is really saying. Please make that your goal. And it's a great goal, and it's a wonderful path on the way. So thank you very much for coming to practice this morning.